Progressive.ca.
You're listening to The Morning Rush with Bill Carroll on News Talk 580 CFRA.
I'm almost done here, but not before I finish chatting with my friend Leslie Roberts. You've probably seen him, good-looking man on the morning TV show.
Have you met my manager, Bill Carroll?
That's right. Well, more than just good looks, a very concise mind and an annoying interviewer. Believe me, I've been on the receiving end of his questions. It's not fun. He grills you.
Well, it's our job, like you, right? Advocate of the people. And today, for example, Andrea Horvath, she was talking about, it's time for the minister to resign. And I was like, okay, it's great, but what's that going to do to fix the problem? It's easy to say, accountability, the minister's gone. Now what? So come to the table with solutions.
So it's really interesting to try to focus it on any one minister, any one government, yeah. When how has it been different anywhere in the world? Long-term care homes have been ground zero of this pandemic outbreak. Every time there's a flu outbreak, every year, it's long-term care homes. We're not any different. We're better than Quebec, probably, and they have a lot more public system than we have. And it's not been better in New York or Los Angeles. Listen, that's not to say we should ignore the problem. But maybe at some point, it's on all of us for warehousing our elders.
Love that, the way you describe it, warehousing. You know, it's
interesting. That's what we've done, right? There was a time when you brought grandma or grandpa, your mother or father aging, to your house to look after them.
I live with my grandma.
Believe me, I have a mother who needs a lot of medical
care.
That's
the difference.
And it's really difficult, especially some of her needs are very personal. And I've had to help her with it. And my brother does too. And it's really embarrassing for her to have a child look after some basic needs. So it's a difficult thing. And sometimes the medical needs are so complicated, you just can't handle them. But generally speaking, we have been ignoring the problem for years. And there are a lot of good facilities out there, too. And there are a few bad ones.
It's a mindset.
They're really expensive, too. And so there's a lot going on there. To just blame Mary Lee Fullerton on all of this and ever resign is, you're right, it's useless.
And it's back to your point about society. It's a mindset. I love the way you say warehousing, because I was married to a Spanish girl. In her culture, the parents lived with us till they died, Bill. I was in Bali, lucky enough to spend some time there, and I went into a family compound. Now, it's not luxurious, don't get me wrong, it's a piece of land, and they cordon off where every member of the family. So the two kids with their kids, the grandparents got the best unit in the entire compound. It was about respect for the elders. When did that get lost in our society? I mean, I lived with my grandmother until she couldn't live with us anymore. So,
my mother-in-law just moved in.
Yeah. Well, good
on
you.
She's still healthy. She'll be more help than hindrance in the beginning, but in time.
So when did we have that shift in society to allow us to warehouse? I'm going to use that a lot.
I think it's when we started to have working families and not just working dads.
Yes.
Right? Because, I mean, everything we're saying, I think, is true. But how do you manage it in the real world where the husband and wife are both at work and there's no one home? Well, there's no one to take care of them for 8 hours or 10 hours.
Well, that was the case when I was married. And when we were at work, we had a PSW who came to the house. And instead of spending X amount of thousands of dollars every month to put her in a home where that care was happening, we had a PSW who would come in, first for both of them, because they were elderly. And then afterwards, after my mother-in-law died, it was for my father-in-law at the time.
Yeah, we have PSWs coming to visit my mother in Oshawa.
Exactly.
And some of them are really good, and some of them, because my brother has them on videotape, and they're all informed of this. Yeah. Some of them just come in and watch TV. They don't really do much. And an hour a day is not enough.
This goes back to the whole issue, though, of how we're allowing the standards to fall. We're seeing huge cuts. In fact, listen to Andrea Horvath as I put it to her. I said, look, it's great that you're calling for resignations. I want solutions. Here's what she said.
I don't disagree with you that in terms of the time what's needed at this point in time now is action. Absolutely. But that action has been needed for a very, very long time and has simply not come to pass by either the Liberals or the Conservatives. You don't fix a system by pulling $34 million out of it. You don't fix a system by continuing to repress the wages of the who we now call healthcare heroes inside that system. It's just been awful. And if one thing I can say that we can do right now is we can make sure that those inspections are being done. We can make sure the full public inquiry happens, and we can get the hospitals and public health to take over those homes. And there are still many of them, including the five that were in the report, that are not up to par in terms of managing their homes. They need to have the government needs to use that power that they just recently gave themselves, by the way. BC gave themselves the power to take over homes at the beginning of this crisis. The Conservative government did it 2 weeks ago. They've taken over two homes. There are several more that need to be taken over, and probably much more than that, and that needs to happen.
So, of course, she's using the moment to nationalize everything because that's what she believes in.
Right.
Fine. Okay, let's spend more money on our seniors. That means what? Less money for our schools or less money in the hospitals for younger people who need heart surgery and cancer. And I mean, there aren't unlimited funds to go around.
So what's the solution if not to spend more money where it's needed? Because these people are living in terrible
situations. But it's needed
everywhere.
So our kids need to get an education. We need to put money in our hospitals.
I agree.
We have hallway healthcare. So, you know, it's just easy to say spend money on the problem. Ultimately, is that the idea? Make it public and let them handle it as opposed to let someone who's trying to make a profit on it? You know, if you want to make a profit, really, you have to be accountable too, because in the end, people are going to pay big money, but they want to be treated well. So you can't just say we'll make it public and let the public health officials, who have misled us many times in the past 3 months.
Yeah.
You know, they could have shut those facilities down on day one.
They did in BC,
shutting everything else down.
In BC,
they could have done better. But, you know, I've talked to people whose parents are in those homes are upset because they did shut them down. They said, you know, my mother is dying alone. I should be able to get in there and hold her hand. Well, that could impact on the health of other people. There are no easy answers there. So for Andrea Horvath to try to make it into a political thing, kind of unseemly, I think.
Well, right? I said exactly that. I said, this is not a time for politics, with all due respect. And she took offense to that. She said, I've been jumping up and down for 10 years. She's been NDP leader here for 10 years. Before that, Howard Hampton. They were pleading at press conferences saying, can anybody hear us? These issues are going on. And they fell on deaf ears, be it with the current government or the previous Liberal government. She's got
enough finger pointing. Sure. And in Ontario and in Quebec and in British Columbia, all over. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. We have to do better because we're all getting older. And there's a huge bubble. We're soon going to have more seniors, if we're not already there, than any time in this country's history. And are we all going to be warehoused like this? I mean, if you don't care about grandma, think about it when your time comes.
Yeah.
How do you want to be treated? These are difficult issues for sure. And, you know, maybe the answer will be more of us will take care of people at home and we'll have more PSWs who can spend more time at home. Maybe that's a cheaper solution.
Yeah. I mean, people are hiring nannies. Right. Instead of going daycare, maybe we hire nannies for ourselves when we're old. Or maybe, Bill, you and I do a Golden Girls kind of setup. I'll scratch your back. You scratch mine.
You know what I didn't bring up on the show today?
And
it just occurred to me because I got a text about it. The Toronto Star is going private. A couple of families are buying it for $52 million.
Who are the families?
Can you imagine? One of them is the Bitoffs.
Oh, yeah.
So can you imagine that the Toronto Star, the biggest, most powerful newspaper in the country,
Canada, yeah,
is being given away? $52 million is nothing. The Sun Media deal, what was that, back in the 90s, was 980-something million, like $1 billion. Sun Media, the Star, which has always been much bigger, because it's not just the Star, it's all the other little papers. $52 million.
Well,
that's peanuts.
I know a thing or two. My family, right? They're in the business. My brother's in print. The future is not bright, Bill.
I know.
The numbers are dwindling. The advertising dollars are going away. You know, they're coming here, thank God.
Well,
to
I'm
broadcast.
Saying as a measure of how sad that is.
It is sad.
That we've reached that point. I mean, when I worked for Standard Broadcasting, I remember they bought an FM radio station, one station, for $100 million.
Yeah, I know. Well, didn't the owner make $1 billion when he sold his station?
Yeah, over $1 billion.
Yeah, over $1 billion.
For selling the radio station. Yeah. So $52 million. And we're in big trouble. But you know what? Karen on Facebook has all the answers. We don't need mainstream media anymore.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, now all of a sudden you're going to have people who are running it who are family-based. Does that mean that the whole unbiased, or in your case, when it comes to Toronto Star, the liberal bias will change?
Could the Star's bias be any worse?
Become conservative?
Than it is right now.
Yeah.
I love when they put the Citizen and the Post, no, the Citizen and the Sun together. One liberal, the other one conservative said, oh, don't worry, it won't have an impact on the, yeah. Okay.
What has been the impact? Because I haven't watched the papers here locally.
The same reporters are writing for both newspapers.
So it's just the columnists who are slanted?
Maybe a little, but you're still beholden to the same boss. So it's in the back of your mind. It's got to impact on some. Unless you're a real rebel like Brian Lilly, you're just going to write what you're going to write, and not everybody has balls that big.
Speaking of rebels. And I don't know how big the balls are if people are going out these days. But you know those circles that they're painting in cities? You've talked about it a couple of times in parks. So this is a bottom line after what happened at Tourney Bellwoods in Toronto, where the Yahoos went crazy because they weren't, many people say, respecting social distancing. I asked the mayor this morning. I said, what do you think, Mr. Mayor? The temperature's rising. We had a number of bylaw complaints, especially one park in Barrhaven on the weekend. What do you think of the idea of chalk circles in parks? Here's what he told me.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I've seen it in other jurisdictions around North America, and it's just common sense, you know. Stay 2 meters away. Don't be with more than five people, in a group. And, when possible in a crowded setting, wear a mask.
What do you think? Do we need these painted circles in Ottawa?
I don't see why we wouldn't. I mean, they're not expensive to do. We have the staff to do it.
They're doing nothing else.
I think
it's
a bad idea.
Yeah. No, I think it would be a preventative measure. We could lead the country. And more importantly, we could use it in our case to reopen regionally, which is something, as we know, in the last 24 hours, we had 7 new cases. And then the day before that, we had 5 new cases in a province where they've been hitting 400. But then we finally got a break provincially, 287. So the number might be a blip, but the number's coming down. But they're not prepared to open regionally just yet, even though a lot of people want it. The mayor says he's deferring to the premier, which is good politics, and believes that the last thing he needs is that we reopen and then have to shut down again.
Yeah, we're going to have to think regionally, that's for sure, especially when the next wave comes and almost all the medical experts say it's inevitable. Then we need to shut down regionally and sometimes by neighborhood. You know, shut down an office that has an outbreak, clean it up, test everybody, then come back to work. Don't shut down the world again, because we can't. We can't keep doing this.
We should know by tomorrow or Friday the results of, if any, negative when it comes to what happened in Toronto. That's what Dr. Williams said. So we'll watch for those numbers in the next couple of days and see if that...
They think they'll see cases that fast.
That's what Dr. Williams said. I know. I was kind of surprised. Isn't it two weeks? Maybe they're all getting
tested.
Well,
2 weeks is kind of the longest.
Yeah.
Right?
But he thinks he'll see some numbers jump. Or if they're going to jump, he said you'll start to see that in the next couple of days.
Yeah. On the other hand, I heard lots of other experts say chances of spreading it outdoors are really small.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe that's the argument if nothing changes or if the numbers keep coming down. Maybe we can say, hey, the proof is there. Lots happening as, of course, the seasons shift. Thank you, Bill.
Okay.
Bill's back tomorrow morning, of course, at 6 a.m. All right, let's get a little deeper into what the military uncovered yesterday. And in many ways, they're seen as the heroes here because, as Bill said, as Andrea Horvath has said, as everybody has said, in terms of this issue, this is a hot potato that's been around for a long time, and we somehow have ignored it. There have been a lot of people jumping up and down and screaming about it, not only in their role as politicians, but also as advocates, family advocates, people who have lived this firsthand, using their position in society, in their careers, to try and advance the fight to make it better for seniors in our society. And my first guest this morning is one of them. Daniel Nasrallah is an Ottawa lawyer, leading practitioner in the area of elder law, and a partner at DNG Law. Good to talk to you. Thank you for your time this morning, Daniel.
Good morning, Leslie.
I guess you weren't surprised with what we found. Were you shocked?
I definitely was not shocked. We've been screaming this from the rooftops for several years now, myself, others before me, others with my help, my clients as well. There's nothing new in this report. It's just unfortunate that it took a worldwide pandemic and an unimaginable loss of life and long-term care for political actors to finally take matters seriously.
Well, that's a very important fact that we need to say from the outset. This is not a COVID-19 story.
It's not a COVID-19 story. Unfortunately, it is intermingled with COVID-19, but these matters have been brought to the attention of every single political actor for at least 3 years since my involvement and well before mine.
I started my day with an interview with Andrea Horvath, and the first thing I said to her was, I hear that you want to call for the resignation of the Minister of Long-Term Care. local MPP, of course, Merrily Fullerton, but I said, what is that going to achieve? Isn't it just more of the same? It makes headlines for a few weeks, and then maybe this time there'll be an inquiry that'll last for a few months. But will anything change? If not, how do we make that happen, Daniel?
Well, Dr. Fullerton, who is the Minister of Long-Term Care in the province of Ontario, I intermingle her comments with the comments of Premier Ford from yesterday, where he stated, and I quote, until yesterday morning, we do not know the full extent of what these residents were dealing with. Well, that's Premier Ford, and that's simply untrue. And if you mix that with Dr. Fullerton's column that she penned for the Ottawa Citizen in September of 2019, which she titled her Vision for Better Long-Term Care in Ontario, she explained her government's progress in long-term care, but acknowledged there were shortfalls. So these issues are not new, and I don't believe it is a political issue, and it should not be a political game. Again, these issues started with the Liberals in power in the province of Ontario for the past dozen years, and continued with the Conservatives. So at the end of the day, this is not a political issue, and it should not be politicized. And I can tell you, I work with local MPP on Ottawa Centre, Joel Hardin. He's an NDP, but at the same time, he's not making this a political issue. He truly cares.
Yeah.
I don't understand what calling for the resignation of the head of an organization at this time during a pandemic would do, except play politics, to be honest.
And that's what I said to her. And, you know, I even went on to say, hey, you've been in charge of the NDP here in the province for 10 years. You know, when you go into these homes, and she says she has, and seen these things, what are you doing to make change? And she talks about, well, we've made press conferences. I've stood up in the House. Even Howard Hampton, her predecessor, was at a press conference famously and said, you know, what's it going to take for people to notice this? And no one did. How do we know this time it's going to change?
Well, I can tell you, I'm not a politician. I am a lawyer, though, and I'm a leading practitioner, as you introduced me in the segment to interview.
Yeah, this is your wheelhouse.
Well, it is, and it became that by the will of God. And at the end of the day, I could tell you I've made progress. I've gone to court on numerous issues, trespass being the largest one, working with the Mary Sardellis case back in the fall of 2019. It was subject to a CBC Marketplace documentary.
That's where they had the hidden cameras?
No, that's the one where they were issuing trespass notices in a retirement home in the city of Ottawa against a family member.
Huh.
And most of these trespass notices were issued in cases where family members were just raising alarms about the care of their loved ones who were residents in long-term care.
So the bottom line, the home was trying to say they're actually interfering in the care as opposed to trying to expose what was going on.
It's interference, and then it becomes occupational health and safety. You're harassing staff and otherwise because you're raising issues. So,
'cause you want your family members to have good care.
Well, absolutely. It's your right. It's your legal obligation, especially when you're a power of attorney. I mean, that's your legal duty. And so, working with the City of Ottawa, they actually enacted new policy about how they issue trespass notices in their four homes and across their corporate bodies in the City of Ottawa. And that was progress we made on another file I worked with. There is change. There has been change. It's just taking too much time. We're about 18 years away. 3 years ago, I said we're about 21 years away from change. The legal system's trying to catch up. And we're about 17, 18 years now.
Huh. Is the solution taking profit out of the equation?
That's part of it. I mean, I could tell you so many personal experiences I've had where in a profit home, in one of the homes actually identified as probably the most egregious in the city of Ottawa in terms of COVID positive results and deaths resulting, I witnessed their director of care in a code blue situation where a resident was in cardiac arrest, essentially lackadaisically taking her time to get up there, and it was witnessed by the family members of my clients who are not related to this individual in distress, take her time, and I had to accost her, say, you're the director of care, get up there, somebody's dying.
Wow.
And it was literally, oh, I'll wait for the elevator. Well, the elevator's not coming, take the stairs. Oh, well, no, I'm going to take my time. The things I've seen, Leslie, it's bizarro world. I explain to people, long-term care is bizarro world.
Yeah.
It's flip what you think is normal or logical right on its head, and that's long-term care.
You know, not to point fingers, but I see some signs of what's happening at one of the city-run homes here, Peter D. Clark Home.
Mm-hmm.
We have a 21st resident testing positive.
Mm-hmm.
This was the latest news. 18 staff members of the facility have also tested positive. 4 residents and an employee at the home have also died. I asked the mayor about it this morning. He says, we're on it. You know, it's not just, care. It's also a virus, and therefore this home had been hard hit. But that's a red flag for me. Am I overreacting?
Unfortunately, I received word last night from a client that my client has passed away. So I'm still inquiring if that's related to COVID, and that individual was a resident at Peter D. Clark, unfortunately. and obviously my condolences, and it affects me because these individuals do become family members to me. So I'm still learning about that. These are severe red flags. I'm going to give you an exact example of how, and I'm going to use the word incompetent staff and management may be at these city-run homes, okay? So my grandfather's case, he needed a catheter inserted several days ago. And there's nurses that work for the city of Ottawa, and they were unable to install a catheter in my grandfather. They had to, in turn, transfer him to hospital to have a nurse at hospital. And again, a nurse in hospital should be just as qualified as a nurse in long-term care. And the nurse took about 5-10 minutes to do it in hospital, and they had to transfer him back. For an elderly person with dementia, that is a severe, traumatizing and inconvenience and a stressful experience because you're shifting them from their home, in ambulance, outside, in and out, to hospital, exposing them to COVID, sending them back, all for something that should be a readily available service in long-term care. And it is not. We see that all the time. It was actually a catheter was an issue that was raised in the report by the Canadian Armed Forces, which I've read, as an issue in Etobicoke. So,
but I wonder, again, you know, in throwing this out there, every nurse is trained in putting in a catheter. I assume that the home hired someone with the qualifications. Could this just be a bad nurse? I mean, every profession, regardless of medicine or not, have bad apples.
They've tried several nurses. This wasn't the first nurse that tried to install the catheter and insert the catheter in my grandfather. So, yeah, no, there were several nurses that tried. And, again, another city-run home. It's not to Peter D. Clark, but it's another city-run home. There, you know, there are numerous examples, some I can speak about, some covered by confidentiality, unfortunately, and fortunately for, you know, depending on how you look at it, unfortunately for the public interest. But I have severe concerns about the competence of staff and management at various homes across the city of Ottawa, not just the ones run by the city of Ottawa.
Are city councillors raising this and screaming up and down at city council? Because I haven't heard that since I've been here.
No, they don't. In fact, I can tell you going back to 2017, when my grandfather was punched 11 times in the face, Mayor Watson, I actually, in conversation with council for the city of Ottawa, I asked for an apology, a public apology from Mayor Watson. You know, saying, I'm sorry this happened to your grandfather. Something to acknowledge. Yes, the system needs change. To this day, 3 years later, I have not received and our family has not received any sort of acknowledgement or remorse or apology from Mayor Watson.
Well, the final question, I guess, is why isn't more being said about this? Is it just a matter of time because we need to send the army in locally or the equivalent to expose? That's why I was asking about this particular one, because the numbers don't look good at the Peter D. Clark.
The numbers don't look good. The numbers at Madonna don't look good.
Right.
We've got local MPs and MPPs asking for the province to go into Madonna long-term care home, which is in worse shape, if we want to consider it that, comparable to Peter D. Clark, and they still haven't even gone into Madonna here in Ottawa.
Is it because we're not in Toronto or the Toronto area, the 905? Because that's where most of them were, right? The five?
I believe so, yeah. It's in the surrounding GTA one way or another, but ultimately, I don't think it is a Toronto issue. I think it is more the Mayor Watson, people at the highest level of council, the executive branch, basically making enough noise to bring the attention to Ottawa. But I think a lot of these long-term care homes, remember, City of Ottawa is involved in four in the City of Ottawa alone. So they don't want this to become a high-profile issue that we have issues in Ottawa.
But with all due respect, Daniel, I don't expect these politicians who are human beings to try and do a cover-up.
Well, they're better than that. It's not... They don't do a cover-up, but you've got to understand, when your hand's in the pot, you do try to limit liability. So that's, I've seen it, I have personal experience with that. It's not necessarily just a matter of maybe negligence or maybe intent, I don't know. But at the end of the day, truthfully, if you wanted the military to come here, based on what I'm hearing, all you have to do is ask.
I'm going to follow up with the mayor on that. Hey, Daniel Nazarala, it's always great to talk to you for insight and some history into what is an becoming a front burner issue again, despite sitting on the back burner and boiling over, people did very little. Hopefully, at the end of this, that come September, we'll have some action, actually reach it to the homes and not sitting on a desk gathering dust somewhere.
I remain cautiously optimistic, Leslie.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Have a great
day. We'll
be
talking again.
Thank you.
Ottawa lawyer, leading practitioner in the area of elder law, someone who's living this firsthand with his own dad, Daniel Nazarala. 10:21, we come back. My conversation with the mayor this morning, where I talk about the issue in the city-owned homes, as well as urban sprawl. Are you ready for 400,000 additional Ottawans in the next 25 years? What's it going to look like? We'll talk about that next here on News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA. CFRA.
It is a busy day at Ottawa City Hall. The contentious urban boundary expansion is being put to a vote at council today. I talked to the mayor about that, but also I wanted to get his take on the news this morning that the provincial emergency order has now been extended until June 9th and how that could affect reopening here in the city of Ottawa. Here's the conversation with Jim Watson.
I want to get your first reaction to the breaking news this morning about the emergency order that's being extended. It's primarily because of provincial numbers. Still, 287 new COVID cases yesterday, but after a string of 400-plus days. And also because of the behavior of Torontonians on the weekend. We only had 5 new cases 2 days ago, 7 yesterday. Is it time to turn up the heat and get the regional reopenings considered now?
Well, that's one of the options that we're looking at. And, the reality is that the province is the lead on these decisions. And I support what the premier and the province have been doing. It's a slow but steady approach to reopening parts of our economy. The last thing we want to do is to open things too quickly. And then we end up in a situation where we have to put back the hands of time and then start laying people off again. I think that would be more traumatic to go through that twice. For employees and people working in various sectors. So look, at the end of the day, we still see our numbers, we haven't had a day when there hasn't been a new case, number one, and we still see too many people dying. So I support what the province is doing.
Let's talk, if we can, actually local reaction to the military report, specifically the city-run homes here. A 21st resident of Peter D. Clark home tested positive. 18 staff members of the facility have also tested positive. 4 residents and an employee of the home have also died. Do we know for a fact that everything that should be done is being done inside the home, given the light that has been shed by the military across the province?
Yeah, obviously the military report on those 5 Toronto area homes is very, very gut-wrenching and disturbing. As you pointed out, the city owns 4 long-term care homes. I'm very proud of the fact that we're taking every possible precaution to ensure that we limit the transmission of the virus. You saw a couple weeks ago concern about people not being able to visit loved ones and window visits and so on. We solved that, but when it's in a lockdown, we really don't allow people to come and go freely, and that's the right thing to do. It seems crass not with a warm heart where you're not allowing people to come in to see their loved ones, but there are exceptions when the loved one is dying. But we need to control the outbreak that's taken place at Peter D. Clark, and you have to do that with some tough decisions. So our staff are doing a remarkable job. We have 3 other centers as well, and they're doing very good work as well.
But are you worried that that's a red flag, that there's not the kind of care that we should expect?
I think there are 2 issues. There's the care, and what the military found was very disturbing in terms of the quality of the food and lack of support and so on. And then there's the virus. I think the quality of care that is given at our 4 city-run facilities is second to none. But like every other, almost every other facility in the province, there have been cases of COVID-D, and our job now is to minimize those and reduce the spread to other centers.
All right, Mr. Mayor, let's move on to what's happening today. The vote on expanding the urban boundary here. I don't have to tell you there's opposition from several councillors. Leeper, Menard, go through the list. They're worried about, full participation, and it's being rushed through during a pandemic. Why the urgency? Couldn't have waited till City Council resumed to, normal council meetings in City Hall?
Well, unfortunately, the business of the government doesn't stop because of the pandemic. In fact, we haven't canceled one council meeting. We've continued on with business. This is not something that just popped up in the last month or so. We've been working on this for well over a year and a half, and there'll be many more steps in the months to come with the zoning bylaw, for instance. The reality is that people want to move to Ottawa. It's a very popular destination. You're a good example of that, Leslie. You moved to this city, which is great, and people need a place to live. And in order to do that, we have to have a balanced approach, and that's why I'm supporting the balanced approach option. There are 3 options. The balanced approach option allows us to have some expansion of the urban boundary, but protecting agricultural land, prime agricultural land, and it allows us to intensify more inside the urban boundary. But the problem we find ourselves in all the time, Leslie, is that people who don't want to expand the urban boundary are often the same people that are voting against an intensification project in their own ward. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say I'm for intensification except not in my backyard. So what we're trying to do is bring forward a balanced approach. And the vast majority of people who I've talked to about this understand that there is a need to make sure that we have a range of houses. Not everyone wants to live in a condo. People want to live in a semi-detached or a single-family home. And I think we have to provide those options for people who want to move here, establish a business, grow their family.
And you're confident that the plan that is going to be likely passing today is one that has been completely examined and is in the best interests of Ottawans going forward?
Absolutely. And we have some of the best urban planners in all of Canada working behind me here at City Hall. And they would not put their signature on a document that they had any doubt or reservation about. And I think, you know, it's great to have a healthy debate, but at the same time, you have to be pragmatic. We project, you know, hundreds of thousands of more people are going to be moving to Ottawa. We need places for them to stay and to live and to raise their families.
So there you have it. That's the mayor. It's being voted on today. We should tell you the urban boundary will be expanded by more than 1,600 hectares, and they're expecting 400,000 more residents to move to the city over the next 25 years. It is expected to pass, and of course, when the coverage does happen, you'll hear it right here on News Talk 580 CFRA. We'll pause for news. On the other side, why do so many Canadians doubt the news about the COVID-19 pandemic? Many say it's being overblown. We'll get into that next here on News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
We like to say we're in this together, but a new poll shows that maybe not everybody agrees that we're in this together. Have you heard about this new poll? It was done by Léger, credible firm. One in five Canadians are not taking the deadly COVID-19 pandemic seriously. The Léger poll says 16% of respondents find the crisis was blown out of proportion. Another 4% believed it was blown way out of proportion. There are some more numbers that are interesting. 16% said the crisis is having no impact on going to stores, restaurants, or other places. 17% said it's having no impact on social distancing they're keeping from others. And 21% say it's having no impact on visits with friends and families. So we're talking about 20%. It's probably the same 20% who are saying, oh, it's not so bad, and then not following the orders right now. That's a lot of people, one in five. To say that not everyone is thrilled with the way that the governments have been handling this pandemic, I think it's an understatement these days. Things keep evolving, right? That's what we hear. Well, it's not the same. We're getting new information. How do experts feel about the lack of clarity and what really has become mixed messaging? Or is it mixed messaging? Amir Adaran is a professor at University of Ottawa School of Epidemiology and Public Health and its Faculty of Law. He checks several boxes. Expert indeed. Amir Adaran, good morning.
Good morning.
Are you surprised by this poll that shows, well, 20% really are shrugging their shoulders and saying, what's the big deal?
I'm sickened by it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm surprised, but who are these people? And you know, I look at my neighbors, and I certainly hope none of them is that close to me. Because if somebody really thinks that what is happening to us as a country, as a planet with COVID, doesn't require them to change their habits to keep themselves and others safe, they are scraping the bottom of stupidity in that belief, and they're dangerous.
That being said, the messages have changed. We've seen a lot of people publicly ask questions about the credibility and the qualifications of some of the people in charge because of flip-flops on masks. I mean, go through the list, right? I don't have to tell you.
You're right. And it's disappointing that our governments have not communicated clearly with us. I know what you're thinking of, Theresa Tam changing her mind on whether we should or shouldn't wear masks.
Well, and other medical officers of health as well.
That's right. And most of them, to my thinking, have done a failing job. I personally don't believe that Tam should be in that job any longer. I think she, through the mask fiasco and a number of other mistakes,
what other
really
mistakes?
Well, she's also never released a single epidemiological model, a forecast, that is, of the epidemic that we can trust. And that to me is shocking, because I look at the performance of countries like Norway or Germany that release those models literally every single day. And it's been months and we're waiting for the public health agency to release the model. She's made noises about one. She's made inconsistent claims about one, but she hasn't actually released the model for us to see.
Why do you think she's still holding that position? I think I know the answer here, but I'm asking you.
Oh, I think she's exceptionally loyal to the minister and the prime minister. And she's a very good bureaucrat, but she's not a great, you know, officer responsible for medical matters and for public health.
I was going to say, this is a scientist's role for the most part. And we have one here in Ontario, of course, Dr. Williams. And a lot of people see that they say they're lacking leadership. But isn't the leadership political and the fact gathering scientific? Are we expecting too much of them?
We should expect them to behave as the guarantors of our public health. Now, in doing so, I think they would run into tremendous headwinds from the government, whether that's Doug Ford's government or Justin Trudeau's. But an ethical person who is behaving as a public health officer has to be willing to stand up for public health. And if that costs that person's support in the government, or even costs a job, that is what you do.
Is there anyone?
Do not allow yourself to become subordinated to the political function. Once you do that, you cease being an asset to the province or country that you are meant to serve.
I'm going to use the example of Dr. Fauci in the States versus the Trump. I mean, you're seeing the cracks there. You're seeing he's second-guessing, and he hasn't been fired yet, but borderline. I mean, is that what you want to see? You want to see people saying, I think the premier is wrong, I think the prime minister is wrong?
Absolutely. When they're wrong, absolutely. Now, you hope that they're not wrong very often, but when they're wrong, of course you need a public health officer to call them out. Just as the Auditor General calls out mistakes in spending, it's not as though our government is comprised entirely of loyal little soldiers. We also have watchdogs. We have the Auditor General, we have the Information Commissioner, the Privacy Commissioner, the Parliamentary Budget Officer. All of these are offices where the incumbent is expected to act with a bit of distance from the government and speak truth to power. Theresa Tam, David Williams, have failed utterly in that job.
Could it be we're expecting too much of them? What I mean by that is, you say, and let's flip around the argument. Could it be that the Prime Minister and the Premier are looking to them to take leadership roles, and that's not what they signed up for? They signed up with information gathering and advisor roles.
Then resign.
Really? Okay.
Then resign. And if it's not the job you want, resign and let someone else do it. I mean,
Last I checked, the Premier and the Prime Minister were in charge of decision-making in this country, not the Chief Medical Officer of Health.
That's right. And ultimately, that's where the buck stops, is with Cabinet and with the Prime Minister federally and likewise in the provinces. But it should not be the case that a public health officer is in a position of trying to defend
right.
government missteps or deflect attention from them.
Mm-hmm. The argument that things have evolved and therefore we've changed as the information has come our way isn't holding any water with you?
No, it does. There are many things that have evolved. I mean, we've learned along the way that, COVID, unfortunately, is a threat to people at all ages, not just the elderly. We've learned along the way that not everybody shows symptoms, and that unfortunately makes it more difficult to control. So, sure, scientific knowledge is changing all the time, and when it does, governments have to adapt. But there are certain things that have not changed, and Theresa Tam in particular has been dishonest saying that they did change. Hmm. When she executed a flip-flop on masks, first telling Canadians that there was no use to wear them, then later saying it would be okay if they wore non-medical masks, all in about a week or 10 days, that flip-flop. She justified it by saying there had been research that changed her mind. That is completely false. There was not new research published in that week or 10 days.
Political pressure, potentially.
Or more likely, simply realizing that she was wrong, not being a big enough person to admit I made a mistake, trying to fix the mistake, but not taking responsibility for it, and saying that it was because something else happened, because there was new research, which actually there wasn't.
You're not the only voice here, but you're the strongest I've heard so far. And as a Canadian, and the people who are listening, they're going to start to say, okay, these are mixed messages. Now those in the know, like yourself, U of O's School of Epidemiology, Public Health, and Faculty of Law are saying this, calling out the people who are making the decisions. Why am I even paying attention anymore? You know, if they're getting it wrong half the time, aren't they getting it wrong all the time? Where the numbers are dropping in Ottawa, why are we still not opening up restaurants? You see where I'm going? We're going to start to see civil disobedience.
Look, we can't afford the civil disobedience. I mean, go ahead and be as mad as you want about government not communicating clearly, truthfully, completely to us. Believe me, I'm furious. Okay? So feel free to be mad about it. But do not channel your frustration into the direction of trying to undermine the good work that keeps us safe. Mm-hmm. If you see cases dropping in Ottawa, that's a good thing. But it does not mean that we can all suddenly start licking the playground furniture and being irresponsible and getting infected. If we were to do that, we would be right back to where we were a month ago. We need to eventually lift the measures that control us. We won't be able to lift them completely until there's a vaccine. So that's going to be, face it, months, a year, maybe longer. Just get used to that. And in the meantime, what we are able to open up, we will have to do so very, very carefully, or we reignite the same fire that we've been trying to put out.
I love that you are critical, but also very much in favor of not relaxing measures. I think that's an important distinction. I wanted to hear from you. Amir Adaran, Prof, U of O, School of Epidemiology, Public Health, and Faculty of Law. Thank you for your time. I know you're a busy man.
Thanks so much.
Cheers.
Have a good day.
Use well. 10:47, we'll take a break. More to come on News Talk 580 CFRA.
You're listening to Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Bill Carroll coined the phrase warehousing our seniors. I love the way he described it, because that really is what we have done in many cases. And it's a society problem. It's not a COVID-19 problem. It just so happens that the military went in there. And people are asking me online, they're saying, so is this about the military acting as spies, going in there and then doing a report to embarrass the government? Well, no, because if you remember, it was the provincial premiers who actually called for the military help, and the prime minister answered that call. So I think good on them. I mean, these are the soldiers who fight for us overseas, clearly, and they are fighting for here at home, the people who before them were fighting overseas, the greatest generation. And I have to tell you, I moved to Ontario, back to Ontario in the early 2000s. I lived in Toronto and doing media up there. And it was an ongoing story. We would talk about it. There'd be a press conference. And then the next headline would happen. And then that story would go away. And I don't know why this time I'm so passionate and sort of saying, we can't drop the ball on this. Why now and why not before? I don't know. Is it because of the pandemic? And the fact is, they could have taken the proper measures to potentially stop it like they did out in BC early on. Let's try and dig a little deeper and say, can this be the difference? Candace Rennick, Secretary Treasurer of QP Ontario and a former personal support worker, joining us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Take me back to your PSW days. Was it bad?
Yeah, I mean, it was many years ago. I've been out of the system now for 12 years, but I started working in a long-term care facility when I was 16 years old. And since then, I've pretty much watched the rapid deterioration of, you know, what was once a good system that's, you know, turned into, you know, an institution that's rampant with care crisis. So, you know, it's definitely gotten a lot worse over the last 15 years.
What I like that you have that I don't have is you can kind of trace history. Where did it start to suffer? I mean, you went into it because at that time, we know it was such a great career. Now we're hearing underpaid, overworked, mm-hmm. you know, underprotected. Where did things start to go off the rails?
In the early 90s, there was a care standard in place, a minimum legislated care standard, which guaranteed seniors a level of care based on their acuity levels. The Mike Harris government came in and eliminated that care standard. At the same time, they opened the doors to private operators who have basically taken over the long-term care industry in the province of Ontario. And it really has been since the elimination of the care standard and the opening of the floodgates to the private industry that we really have seen this deterioration of care and quality in long-term care sector.
How are care standards different now from back then in terms of regulations?
Well, I mean, so we don't have the care standard. There is absolutely no guaranteed level of care. Successive governments have moved to deregulate the sector in lots of different ways. There's less investigating, less compliance. People are just run off their feet. Acuity levels, meaning the care levels, the level of care that people need, has increased tremendously, but staffing levels and funding have not kept pace with those increased needs. And so, you know, staff can barely meet the basic needs of the residents on a good day.
It sounds to me like there's a whole checklist that has to be fixed quickly.
Yeah, there's a lot of work to be done, and it's going to take a lot of political will, commitment, and determination to make it happen.
Have you heard the beginning of that in the last 24 hours?
I sure hope so, but, you know, it's great that the military has come down and given this report, but the fact of the matter is that anybody who's been paying attention to long-term care over the past decade, sure, be angered and maddened by this, but nobody can really be surprised, because frontline workers have been ringing these alarm bells for years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, great that people are now starting to pay attention and a spotlight has been shone on this that people can't ignore. But now is the time for real action, because the people who live and work in these facilities can't wait any longer.
You've heard of the abuse. You've heard of the neglect. It's not great image for your, you know, your profession.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think I speak for a lot of people when I say there's absolutely zero tolerance for abuse or willful neglect amongst seniors or anybody for that matter, and people who engage in that kind of activity should be dealt with. But the vast majority of people working in this sector show up every day, they work their hearts out, and they do the best they can to provide loving and dignified care in conditions that are completely untenable and in facilities that are chronically underfunded and understaffed. In many ways, workers have been set up to fail because they don't have the resources they need to even meet the basic requirements of residents from day to day.
In some ways, are you thankful for COVID-19 to bring this to the forefront so that finally there'll be some change?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I hate to rely on a crisis where people have lost their lives in such great numbers. But if this is what it takes to finally bring the kind of systemic change that's needed to enhance the quality of life for people who call these facilities their home, then I welcome that.
Public inquiry is the smallest thing that should be done.
Yeah, I mean, sure, a public inquiry, it has to be truly independent and it has to get to the real heart of the issues. But I also feel a little bit frustrated because I don't want to wait months and maybe even years for a public inquiry or an independent commission to tell us what we already know. We know the system is broken. We know there's a crisis of care at the bedside. We know there's not enough staff. We know there's not enough funding. So what is this going to tell us that we don't already know? I'm not sure. And quite frankly, I don't want to wait months and months for the results of things that we know today.
Do you echo the calls for the resignation of Mary Lee Fullerton?
No, I'm not focused on that, to be honest with you. I want solutions right now, and I just think that people need to be focused on fixing the problem. This has been a crisis of care for over, you know, 15 years in the province, and that's not where I'm focused today.
Are any of the solutions quick fixes that can be implemented while the public inquiry is underway?
There is a call for a legislated care standard to reintroduce care standards in the province. There's a private member's bill before the legislature right now. It's called Bill 13. It would guarantee residents a minimum average of 4 hours of hands-on care per day. The government could pass that this week if they wanted to. They could immediately take that step. You know, we're also calling on the federal government to step in and get involved in a way that they haven't got involved before and bring long-term care across the country under the Canada Health Act, to make it an accessible, publicly funded, and truly universal system that's available to everyone, like our hospital system. And we want the government to be bold and courageous and to stand up and say, no more for-profit providers in long-term care in Ontario. public money going into long-term care must go to support seniors at the bedside, not into the pockets of shareholders.
Given recent history, are you optimistic all what you're calling for is going to happen?
I hope this is our opportunity, and if enough people continue to apply the pressure and demand better for seniors and for our future, then we can make it happen for sure.
You know your stuff. I'm impressed. Seniors in homes obviously have a very strong advocate in you. Candace Rennick, Secretary Treasurer of QP Ontario, former personal support worker, someone who's been there. Thank you for your time this morning. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Mister, again, talking about long-term care homes and that report from the military, I wanted to hang in a little longer there because I have a feeling that was going to be the follow-up questions once he broke away. He said, of course, that was specifically the province of Quebec having read the entire report. The one from Ontario, of course, here, and the five homes that the military called into making headlines. Interesting question there from one of the reporters saying, hey, this is not new. We know that this is an issue. It's been brought to light by the military, called in by the provinces. Would you now consider, Mr. Prime Minister, a national inquiry into long-term care homes? He said, well, conversations will have to continue. We have to continue to respect the provinces. So bottom line, he's stopping short of saying there would be a full-fledged national inquiry. Now, I understand it's a provincial jurisdiction. But there is a minister for seniors who we talked to just a week ago, disappointed with her answers and all this, saying they're doing what they can given their jurisdictions. But this is bigger than provincial and national jurisdictions, if you ask me. Let me ask our next guest, an expert in the field, Laura Tamblyn-Watt, CEO of CanAge, Outspoken. It's Canada's national seniors advocacy organization. She joins us. Hi, Laura. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Would you agree this goes beyond provincial, federal borders?
Absolutely. Canadians are fed up with the jurisdictional finger pointing. We certainly understand and respect the importance of jurisdiction, but this is a shared issue across the country. So I was encouraged to hear the Prime Minister say as much as he did, because ordinarily he would stay out of those waters because they are provincial. But when you're having premiers like Doug Ford, who is a conservative and not usually one to go hand in hand with the federal Liberals, say that he is interested in having a conversation about standard operating procedures or possibly national standards, it opens the way for this needed conversation for change.
Well, everyone's on the same board when it comes to this because of the fact that it was the military that brought this in, and nobody's going to second guess them given what they've exposed and answering the call that the provincial premiers actually asked for help. Is this the tipping point? Is this going to make the change we've been waiting for despite the reports and the horrible stories of the last 20 years?
If this isn't it, I don't know what is. We've had significant loss in life. Canada ranks 14 out of 14 of our OECD comparator countries in terms of how we've done in terms of long-term care and loss of life. We are at a very challenging circumstance when it comes to how we are managing long-term care. So if this isn't it, I don't know what is.
And how do we make sure it is it? Because I can tell you, I've talked to the politicians who've been around through all of this. I've talked to the advocates who've been around through all this. I've talked to the PSWs who have been around through all this. And every time they had faith that something was going to change. What are we doing wrong? What do we have to do differently?
I think we need to look at the Australian model. And they have a jurisdiction very similar to Canada, right? A federal and a state-based model. So quite analogous to that. And what they've done is they've created essentially a National Standards Council, an organization who is charged with ensuring that we get what we need in terms of national standards and that they have the ability to pull a license and levy a substantive fine. But at a minimum, establish what the quality requirements are, and then have the federal government transfer funds dedicated to that to the provinces on the understanding that they must comply with these national standards. That has not been done yet, and it could be a very effective way of moving forward.
Tell me more about Australia. Is there a profit model there, or is it out of the equation?
There's a mix as well. And I mean, we're in this difficult mix in Canada, too. And so I think in both countries, if we wanted to start from scratch, you know, we would probably say, of course, it's part of our healthcare system. Of course, this is not where we want to be making money off of in terms of the lives of older people. We don't want to be scrimping and saving in the areas that we are. But we're not in that model now, and about 50% of all long-term care in this country is provided by for-profit homes. Mm-hmm. And in Ontario, that's 60%. So it's not just as easy as flipping a switch. If they are going to make a decision, there's going to have to be a time of transfer. It's not going to be easy to take over 50% of long-term care homes. And indeed, we could be losing beds. So I think in the end, I think the practical first step is establish those national standards, tie money to it, make sure that licensing and fines are part of it, but then invest in the things that we know we need. Invest in staffing, invest in infrastructure, invest in emotion-focused long-term care as opposed to what we call the medical model. We know what we need to do. We just need the political will and the funding to do it.
We seem to be having most of it. I don't know about the funding because, let's face it, we're running dry. The well is emptying out quickly here. That being said, it should be top priority. Will and let's face it, money is what it's going to take. And they're both right now ready to go.
They are ready to go. And I think austerity measures are certain to happen at some point because you will be spending and then there will be a point where you stop spending.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very helpful to think about investments in long-term care, investments in seniors care, including our home care system, as something that we need to do now. But it's also great make work projects. It has real estate. It has construction. It has healthcare. It has services and social services. So if we're looking to kickstart the economy, you know, shovel-ready projects to support seniors care is a very effective economic driver. And we haven't been talking about that. So there is a really good news story. I think we're starting to get alignment across the jurisdictions in some ways, although I heard the Quebec premier say that he may not be as interested in joining pan-Canadian standards. But I think Canadians are going to hold their governments to account for inaction.
You know, in that province, they've seen some scathing reports in recent years, and this is nothing new to them, even more so than here in Ontario.
You know, when we saw what happened in what Résidence Héron and the other associated residences, you know, we had observers saying it was like a concentration camp. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't think that those words ever get used lightly. We had people abandoned for days at a time, starving, people who had fallen out of bed and left on the floor in their own feces for days. I mean, I don't know what else it's going to take beyond this, but I can tell you that Canadians need to look ahead. We are all aging, and if we want to have a better system, we should help ourselves by investing now.
The other question is, as we're having this debate and we're talking about things that are, you know, have been brought up in this report and dealing with a pandemic, is it true we're also going to lose beds because of fire code regulations?
Right now in Ontario, we have about 76,000 long-term care home beds, 30,000 of which we can lose in 5 years because they don't meet fire codes. They don't have sprinklers associated with them. So we've heard promises from this government about infrastructure support, but we really haven't seen much happen. And if we don't get the investment, you know, we are going to lose about a third of our beds just through attrition for fire codes. We know what we need to do. We need to refresh the building stock. It's pretty old in Ontario. It's newer, say, in BC. And when we do invest, we need to make sure that we have swing space. So one of the big problems with refreshing building stock is that there's nowhere to put people while they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think about schools, if you're rebuilding a school, you have to have a place to put the students. It's ever more the case when you have people who are very vulnerable and have, you know, profound healthcare needs. It's not so easy. So we have to make sure that they're doing this as a specific strategy. We've seen very little action on this. And then new builds should be small. They should be 10 to 20 beds. They should be home-like environments, not institutions. We know that that works better. We know that that works for dementia patients better. We know that people like it better and staff are safer in them. So there's a pathway forward. It's just the will to do it.
Are they financially sustainable models?
They are. In fact, we've had robust reports about what works best. And these models, often called a dementia village, or some call them the Nordic model.
I've seen them.
You know, they're wonderful.
Yeah.
And I mean, one of the other pieces that we really run up against is how to get loan guarantee investments. So in BC, we have much more innovative housing on the West Coast because there is something called BC Housing Corporation, which allows grants and backstops. In Ontario, we don't have sort of those same underwriting for grants And so not-profit homes have to raise millions of dollars themselves just to even get in the game, which is why for-profit homes really are running that province 60% of the time.
Can we take BC's model and make it a template across the country? Would that achieve everything you want?
It would absolutely help to have something like a BC housing model, or at least have something like CMHC, a Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation, help to replicate that same type of grant support or loan underwriting would really help. We know that, you know, long-term care homes who are nonprofits are struggling to get the land, to get the infrastructure. Governments could give land. There's lots of land out there and long-term care homes need it. So, I mean, if you're looking at how they can support it, they could be making sure that land grants are available. That's a very practical thing that they could do tomorrow.
I always learn something when I talk to you. Laura Tamblyn-Watt, CEO of CanAge, Canada's National Seniors Advocacy Organization. Thanks again for your time. I know you're busy.
Always a pleasure. Thank
Cheers.
You.
And when we come back, we're going to talk about asking the teacher. Yeah, it's that time where we're going to kind of help you when it comes to helping your kids or your grandkids. But this time, we're going to take a look at what is special about teaching during a pandemic when stress is high for the kids in particular. And how do we rebuild the resilience that is lost? That's coming up. You can call in. We'll open up the lines as well on the other side of the news right here. News Talk 580. See you.